Now, when the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven by a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. Elijah said to Elisha, "Stay here, for the Lord has sent me as far as Bethel." But Elisha said, "As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So they went down to Bethel. The company of prophets who were in Bethel came out to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that today the Lord will take your master away from you?" And he said, "Yes, I know. Keep silent." Elijah said to him, "Elisha, stay here, for the Lord has sent me to Jericho." But he said, "As the Lord lives and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So they came to Jericho. The company of prophets who were at Jericho drew near to Elisha and said to him, "Do you know that today the Lord will take your master away from you?" And he answered, "Yes, I know. Be silent." And then Elijah said to him, "Stay here, for the Lord has sent me to the Jordan." But he said, "As the Lord lives, and as you yourself live, I will not leave you." So the two of them went on. 50 men of the company of prophets also went and stood at some distance from them, as they both were standing by the Jordan. Then Elijah took his mantle and rolled it up and struck the water. The water was parted to one side and to the other until the two of them crossed on dry ground. When they had crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, "Tell me what I may do for you before I am taken from you." Elisha said, "Please, let me inherit a double share of your spirit." He responded, "You have asked a hard thing. Yet if you see me as I am being taken from you, it will be granted you. If not, it will not." As they continued walking and talking, a chariot of fire and horses of fire separated the two of them, and Elijah ascended in a whirlwind into heaven. Elisha kept watching and crying out, "Father, Father, the chariots of Israel and his horsemen." But when he could no longer see him, he grasped his own clothes and tore them in two pieces. And then he picked up the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him and went back and stood on the bank of the Jordan. He took the mantle of Elijah that had fallen from him and struck the water, saying, "Where is the Lord, the God of Elijah?" And when he had struck the water was parted to one side and to the other, and Elisha went over. The word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. How do you learn who you are in the world and what God desires for your life? I think many of us learn our first lessons about our identity and our purpose, our gifts and our limitations from our parents. Now, for some people that might have sounded like, "You're such a smart girl." "Oh, he's a born artist." Or maybe more like, "He's a good kid, but he can't carry a tune in a bucket." Sometimes we hear more damaging words about our limitations. Now, sometimes our enjoyment as we grow of certain pursuits is enough that we might be able to ignore the naysayers. And over time, our perseverance and practice may overcome our lack of innate talent in a certain area. But other times, we might let self-doubt keep us from trying new things until someone close to us, someone with authority in our lives, gives us the affirmation or the push that we need. How many of you can remember a teacher or someone else in your life who went out of their way to praise you, to affirm you, to comment on your talent or your worth or value, or to encourage you to try something that you were unsure of. Have many of you had that experience in your lives? I know we have some teachers among us as well. It's important work. Sometimes the relationship is very brief, and a word or two is all that it takes to set us on a new path. But other times that person might remain in our lives and continue to guide us as we travel the road together. And sometimes we call that mentoring. Elijah seems to have been that person for Elisha. I know that it's confusing that their names are so similar. I'll just try to enunciate very clearly. Elijah, the Tishbite, had been serving as a prophet for the God of Israel for many years. And his role as prophet was to constantly tell the kings and queens of Israel and Samaria and surrounding areas that they were messing things up. They weren't doing things according to God's will or God's law. And Elijah regularly received death threats for his trouble. In 1 Kings 19, a few chapters earlier than today's reading, you can find the story of Elijah following God's instructions to anoint his own successor, Elisha. And the way that Elijah does this is by throwing his mantle or cloak over Elisha while Elisha is plowing a field with a team of 12 oxen. It's kind of a peculiar way of letting somebody know that they're going to follow in your footsteps, I think. But that story helps explain why the mantle is such a powerful symbol of the role that Elijah is passing on. Mentorship can be a wonderful gift, whether the relationship is formally recognized or not. Right before annual conference, a group of us who are younger clergy gathered, and one of our discussions compared the process of mentoring, of learning from our elders in ministry, to watching one of our young clergy mention that as she is learning to garden, what she does is she watches the older, experienced gardener who lives across the street. She hasn't asked him anything, but she watches what he does to figure out when and how much she should trim the rose bushes and when it's time to fertilize or do other things in her garden. In my own journey, I've been blessed by some wonderful role models for ministry, from my campus minister while I was an undergraduate student to my time serving here at Highlands with Pastor Betty. Not that I expect to see her taken up in a whirlwind with chariots anytime soon. And Paul's father, Lou Blady, was involved in the field education placement program at ILEF, which is an opportunity for seminary students to gain on-the-job training by serving as student pastors in local churches. Sometimes a mentor chooses the student, sometimes the student chooses the teacher, and sometimes the two of them come together, but because of a force that is outside of either one of them. But generally, there must be some kind of mutual discernment for a successful relationship. Of course, just because the relationship is right and helpful doesn't mean that it's always smooth traveling. Elijah says to his protege, "Stay here," three times. And three times, Elisha says, "I don't wanna, I'm coming with you." Now, maybe Elijah is testing Elisha. That's a traditional interpretation of many of the biblical stories where someone who's supposed to be close to God seems to be speaking or acting as though they don't really know what God wants or plans. Devout readers through the centuries have suggested, well, maybe it was just a test, and Elisha had to prove himself by staying committed, even though Elijah said, "Stay here." That's possible. I'm less interested in that interpretation than in seeing this as a pattern of maybe some kind of difficulty between the teacher and the student. I mean, maybe Elijah is an introvert and he's tired of having this guy follow him around all the time and he just wants a little quiet time alone with God. Maybe Elijah doesn't like Elisha all that much and he's being passive-aggressive about letting him carry on the work. Sometimes the old guard might have some difficulty letting go speaking strictly about Elijah now. I mean, Elijah wants to be sure that Elisha has the skills and gifts of a prophet, to see how God is at work in the world and to commit to following through. Both that vision for God's work and perseverance are required because being a prophet was not easy. But neither are gifts that can simply be handed over from one person to another. And so Elijah teaches Elisha how to recognize whether he is on the right path, the path to which God has called him. And so the story raises a number of questions for me, and I invite you to think about who you might be nurturing, encouraging, and equipping to take your place, either in a specific and professional way where you work, or in a more general and spiritual way. Who are you teaching the ways of the faith? Who are you modeling what it means to live out your calling in the world for? Mentoring is a beautiful way to honor the mutual interdependence of people from different generations in a community. As Brandon said with the children need the Sunday school teachers, and the Sunday school teachers need the children. We need each other. The theologian Reinhold Niebuhr put it this way: nothing worth doing is completed in our lifetime. Therefore, we must be saved by hope. Nothing true or beautiful makes complete sense in any immediate context of history. Therefore, we must be saved by faith. Nothing we do, however virtuous, can be accomplished alone. And therefore, we are saved by love. The work to which God calls us, the work of co-creating the kingdom of love, justice, integrity, peace, and compassion, cannot be done alone or isolated from the great cloud of witnesses of whom we are a part, all the saints who have gone before us, and all the generations that will come after us. The mentoring relationship can be a powerful and beautiful way of embodying, incarnating that truth. But sometimes the relationship ends before you're ready. When I was in ninth grade, I had this phenomenal English teacher. His name was Mr. Mailman. And we all giggled about his name in the beginning, but it didn't take very long for our amusement to turn into respect and appreciation. He taught us classic literature and expository writing. He taught us grammar and poetry. And somehow he made the grammar entertaining and the classic literature relevant to our lives. Through his influence, I got involved in our school's literary magazine, submitting a few pieces of my own writing and in my sophomore year serving as an editor. I also became a student intern in the English department where Mr. Mailman was the department head, and I felt that I'd found my calling in pursuing a path to becoming a high school English teacher. Of course, it seems that God had other plans for me, but I didn't know it at the time. And then about a month before the end of my sophomore year, I was at home on a Sunday evening when I got a call from the editor-in-chief, a senior of the literary magazine. He came straight to the point. Mr. Mailman had died of a heart attack at home while making dinner for his family. He was just 39. I was not the only student to find myself in a state of grief that I had never known before. I struggled, as many did, and as the bereaved almost always do, to make sense of this great loss, to come to terms with the idea that my teacher and mentor was gone without any chance to say goodbye, and not yet being schooled in the ebb and flow of grief or the inevitability of loss. I had a dream, though, a week or so later, and it's unusual for me to remember dreams this long, but it was very meaningful to me. In the dream, I was sitting at a lunch counter in a bus station. I don't know that I've ever in my life sat at a lunch counter in a bus station, but that's what happened in the dream. And Mr. Mailman walked by carrying an armload of books, and I called out to him, "They said you died."
And he grinned this crooked grin and quoted Mark Twain about the reports of his death being greatly exaggerated, and he kept walking. And that was my opportunity to say goodbye. So when Elisha starts yelling, "Father, Father, the chariots of Israel and its horsemen," I understand that the theological meaning here is to show that Elisha did have the vision that he needed as a prophet. He could see what was going on, and so that meant that he could serve as Elijah's heir and successor. But reading the story from a more human perspective, what he cries out sounds more like the gibberish that we come up with when we're trying to fill the hole that someone has left in our lives. A person can be taken from you in the middle of a conversation, halfway through your shared journey, just when you feel like you're starting to understand what it is that they've been trying to teach you. And maybe we get angry at God when that happens. Maybe we curse and scream and tear our clothes. Maybe we pick up whatever talisman that person left us to see if we can figure out how to invoke the power, the faith, the comfort that they used to command. The loss is not always because of death. Relationships can end or change shape in a thousand ways, some more painful than others. But however it happens, a mentoring relationship almost always does change form eventually, because it's a kind of relationship that's specific to a segment of a journey that two people are traveling together, and that's usually temporary. Elisha knows that the time has come for his mentor to be taken from him, and just in case he doesn't, there's a company of prophets everywhere he goes that keeps asking him if he knows, to make sure that he's prepared. And he keeps telling them, "I know already, shut up." Maybe Elijah telling him to stay behind is an attempt to help Elisha let go and say goodbye. Whether we know it is coming or not, any kind of transition time can be challenging. A coworker at my nonprofit job has a framed print on her wall that says, "Change of any kind requires courage." This week and next, many of my clergy colleagues are in transition as they leave one church and prepare to begin work in a new place. Annual conference last week highlighted the changes that are happening in the lives of many. Not for me or for Pastor Betty this year, but we celebrated the retirement of more than a dozen clergy with 350 years of ministry among them. We celebrated the commissioning and ordination of others who are just beginning their journeys in ministry, and new appointments for dozens of others. Anytime there is change, grief is a natural part of the process, whether physical death is involved or not. But there comes the moment, even in the midst of our grief, when we realize that we cannot keep chasing the chariot. We have to let go of what has been in order to make room for what is to come. It's not easy. As Elisha takes up the fallen mantle and strikes the water of the Jordan, he doesn't exactly sound like he's sure of himself as he cries out, "Where is the Lord, the God of Elijah?" The question reveals both his loss and his uncertainty in his own authority. Maybe some of you have found yourselves in a place where you had to follow in the footsteps of a beloved leader, not knowing if you were qualified or authorized. It is an act of faith to claim your own authority. One of the commentators that I read this week in my preparation remarked that Elisha's first miracle is to make his own travel a little easier by allowing him to cross the Jordan on dry land. But I don't think so. First of all, there's theological echoes of Moses, the greatest prophet, parting the Red Sea. But it seems more likely to me, again from the more human perspective, that this is just the most recent lesson, the last lesson that Elisha learned from his teacher. And Elisha figures, since it was so recent, he has the best shot at replicating it while the details are still fresh in his memory. I think it's natural for many of us, at least, to start with what is familiar, what we know will work when we're asked to fill someone else's shoes. And after this one specific instance, Elisha's ministry as a prophet takes a very different shape from the work Elijah had been doing. He is freed in that moment to pursue his own calling. It's a very rich story. And though there are some perhaps obvious parallels with the situation for me here this summer, I wonder what connections each of you might find. What is the power or authority that you are still testing or perhaps hesitant to claim in your own life? Whose shoes have seemed too big to fill at one time or another? And what gave you the courage to step into them anyway? How have you known when you found your vocation that you were on the right path? Ultimately, Elisha gets confirmation of that he has inherited the share of Elijah's spirit that means that he is Elijah's successor. He knows that this is his gift and his calling. And though it is right that he mourns the loss of his mentor, the next step is to pick up the mantle and to see if and how God will respond, and then to follow where God leads. There can be no turning back, no abandoning the path just because the teacher is gone. This is what we've been training for, after all. And there is no knowing where the path may lead. The mentor's hindsight may become our foresight, but it doesn't predict the outcome of the journey. All we can do is take the next step as God leads us and try to figure out how we are called to serve God's people and all of the creation. May it be so for you and for me. Amen.